Now we're going through the book of James, and I have said to you in the past that I do not find this book to be at all out of keeping with the spirit of the New Testament in general. Some people seem to have had trouble with it. It seems to them to put a lot of emphasis on so-called works, but I don't see any inconsistency here whatsoever. I get the same spirit in this that I have in. I catch the same sense of the Spirit here as in the other books of the New Testament. I think there are a lot of things here that we ought to look at, and I also keep pressing upon you the following point, that there is a sense in which we ought not to relegate to some miraculous power of the Spirit the simple disciplines of life. There are some things that we just ought to behave ourselves in, whether we have a miracle or not. You know, if you're waiting for some miracle from God to control your tongue, maybe you should just learn how to control it. I'm not sure that we can put that off onto God. We get some help from Him, to be sure, but it's too easy to shirk our responsibility of just behaving ourselves and acting kindly to people and so on. And that's sort of the message that James has, among other things. He's trying to say, for example, that it's important to control the tongue. This is an illustration. You see that the Holy Spirit is in our spirits, and only the Holy Spirit can save us, that is, only the Spirit of Christ in us can bring the life that is needed. There's no way we can bring life to ourselves whatsoever. It takes the power of God. On the other hand, there are certain things in our natural lives that are a matter of good breeding and thoughtfulness to others, consideration for others. There are a lot of Christians that haven't had good breeding. And people look at their lives and say, well, if that's what a Christian is, I don't want to be one. And it has nothing to do with their being a Christian. It has to do with their being had a bad upbringing or something. They don't act right. It has nothing to do with Christianity. There are people that are not Christians that are very charming and very careful about their attitudes and actions with others. And there are people that are Christians that are very careless about their attitudes and actions with others. So I'm saying that James has some very good things here, but the fact that he doesn't bring in highly spiritualistic elements doesn't make it any the less a valid and valuable book. So I think maybe sometimes Christians can get sloppy just trying to leave everything to the Lord to change in them. All right, we're going to go on with this from that sort of introductory comment that we're into the first chapter quite a ways. So many of these words need to be defined and opened up to us, and I think we probably talked about verses 9 through 11 last week, but I'm going to just read them again. Let the lowly brother glory in his exaltation, and the rich in his lowliness, because as a flower of grass of a plant, he shall pass away. Or it shall pass away. For the sun has risen up with the burning heat and withered the grass, and the flower of it has fallen, and the appearance of its face has been destroyed, or the fashion of its face, the form of its face. So also the rich in his goings shall wither, the rich man. The simple statement here is that the whole structure of life is so passing, so transient and temporary, that there's no use to put much weight upon our condition, whatever it is. Now, if we have wealth, some people do, some Christian people have an amount of wealth, James is saying don't put any stock in it, don't exalt or glory in that, but glory in the fact that even though you have wealth, you can yet be a person of lowliness. That takes the power of God. There's something that the human really can't do for themselves, is to have an attitude of humility about things. The more you try to be humble, the more proud you're going to be, especially if you achieve humility, you're going to be proud of your humility. A spirit of humility is something that only the power of God can produce in us. And it is produced by Him not in terms of some quick shot in the arm, some quick miracle of grace, but humility is produced by the daily experiences that the Lord brings about in our lives and our interaction with Christ. Now, one of the things that brings humility is a greater acquaintanceship with Christ. As you expose yourself to the truth, to the Word, you get to know Christ. The more you know of His greatness, the more you see of your own weakness. I doubt if anyone can really fully appreciate the meaning of sin until they have come to grips with the Savior, with Christ. Therefore, to try and teach morality to people that are not Christians is a hopeless task because they have no reference point. It would be a valid statement apart from God. You see, it's a valid statement to say, who's to say what is moral and what is immoral apart from God? Because, after all, if we're only animals, you look to the animal world for morality and you won't find much. There isn't any there. Morality is such, dogs mate on the street corners. So, morality has only meaning in the context of sensitivity to God. The meaning of our own human weakness is, or of sin, is only valid in the light of the strength of Christ. When a person has reason in the flesh, in the natural, to be proud, the VIP, for example, or the person of wealth, they may have reason in the natural to be exalted or lifted up with pride. But as they associate with Christ, there will come a genuine lowliness or genuine humility that is not based upon a thought that even though I'm great, I ought to see myself as lowly, but seeing oneself as lowly because in fact we are, compared to Christ, we're lowly. So he's saying, on the one hand, to the people that have reason in the natural to be proud, they should glory in the fact that the Spirit of Christ in them has given them the capacity to be lowly or to see themselves for what they really are. With the tinsel off, see, everybody's the same. When you get the tinsel off, we're all alike inside. On the other hand, there is the poor person, and maybe we're perhaps talking about not only money, but a position of various kinds. Here's the truly lowly person, the truly ill-born or not well-born in this world, the person who has a series of unfortunate circumstances or whatever. And James is saying to that person, let your glory be in that you are, as a matter of fact, exalted in Christ. You see, you're the child of a king. Only the power of the Spirit can level us out so that the person who has good circumstances in this life yet keeps a proper perspective on those things, and the person who has poor circumstances in this life keeps a proper perspective. So instead of indulging in self-pity, the poor realizes that there's more to life than wealth or more to life than position, and they're at peace. The person who has wealth doesn't put stock in that wealth, but says that, well, that's here as a passing, transient thing, and our true reality is in the Spirit of Christ, or in Christ within our hearts. But, you see, this kind of leveling is itself the great miracle of grace. How you behave yourself in courtesy and kindness to others may be a matter of just behaving yourself or self-discipline, but being humble or lowly, or on the other hand, having the right perspective about things, has got to be a gift of God. We have to separate these things. That's the value of this book of James. You've got to separate out the things that are something we can take care of in our natural selves and the things that only the Spirit of Christ can accomplish within us. The great analogy here, of course, is the flower and the growing thing of the field. And he says that you have to look at life with the same transiency that you see the blossom on a flower in the field. The sun rises and it's withered. If you have a series of difficult circumstances, there are only going to be a few years on the earth that you're going to have to put up with it anyway. You're here for a few years, you have your problems. It's not going to be permanent, thank God for that. It isn't all you're going to get out of life if you're a follower of Christ. You have a few years on the earth, and it's over. In the last analysis, whatever we are is in the hands of God. We have a few years on the earth, a little bit of pleasure, a little bit of pain, and then we have eternity with God. I quoted these lines somewhere, I don't know, I think another meeting in the South. But I put some lines together here a couple of years ago that move in that direction. Pressing onward to the eternal portals, besieged mortals, struggling with life, reaching out for that to which their soul may cling. A moment of pleasure, a moment of purpose, a moment of pain, and then to wing, and all we ever were is in the hands of God. That's what life amounts to, a moment of pleasure, a moment of purpose, a moment of pain. It's such a moment in the overall spectrum of things that we can handle it. I say whatever your circumstances are now, you can handle it. It's a moment in comparison to eternity. So at every point, we strengthen the principles and go by the principles rather than by the circumstances. We don't use the criterion of what we call situation ethics. By situation ethics, we mean we try to extract the most out of every situation, whatever the principles we have to use or abuse to do it. That's situation ethics. You decide your ethics on the basis of the situation rather than on the basis of the principles behind life. So if for the sake of, for example, of course the most important point is, cogent example would be, for example, if one is working somewhere on a job and you have an opportunity to get ahead a little bit, and in doing so you have to compromise some simple principles. Maybe the boss wants you to compromise some principles in the way you handle letters or customers or many different ways that one might be asked to sort of cover up a little bit. See, situation ethics means that you decide what you're going to do on the basis of the situation and not on the basis of underlying principles. I'm saying to you, life being temporary as it is, and the cultivation of our spirit being the eternal thing, therefore every decision we make ought to be based upon the effect that it has upon our eternal spirit, rather than the immediate advantage we might get out of life. That seems a simple principle, but people violate it all the time. And James gives us some help here by indicating how temporary life is, and it's silly to compromise yourself for something that is so temporary. Well, we're going to move on now to verse 12. Blessed is the person who endures testing, because when he is tried, he shall receive the crown of life, which is promised to those who love him. We've got to look at all of these words. Again, I've often said we're confused and often about doctrine because we don't understand the words. I'm going to go first to the idea of testing, and then we're going to look at the word blessed again and see what we mean by that. What does it mean, blessed is the one who endures temptation? The central word again here is temptation or testing. We have translated that for you in the past, in an earlier verse here in James 1, as an assault, a testing or an assault. Now, this word would be translated in many texts by the word temptation. In fact, in the King James text, it says here, "Blessed is the man that endures temptation, for when he is tried, he shall receive a crown of life." Now, temptation, as we've said, and we'll just briefly review it for you, the word temptation tends to have a connotation of morality to it. We usually associate it with that. But the Bible uses the word in a far broader way. Tempting is, in the biblical sense, testing. Now, of course, temptation, even in the moral sense, is a testing of one's morality. But to keep the word in perspective, it means a test, or if we go back to its original roots in the classic form, the Greek classics, it means to assault, like the assaulting of a citadel. Now, I went into that here one night, so I won't take too long with it. But if you see the word as meaning an assault upon us, Satan continually makes an assault upon humanity. He tries, on the one hand, to spoil the things that God has made. And he tries, on the other hand, to get people to curse God, if he can bring enough adversity into their life to get them to blame God for things and curse him, he has won a point. Or if he can get people to give up the faith because they don't understand why there is suffering in the world. One of the very well-known evangelists not too long ago was pegged as having given up the faith, which he did, in fact. He'd been an evangelist of a stature similar to that of Billy Graham's in his earlier years. I think he never reached the present stature of Billy Graham, but he was that in that stream of evangelists in this country that were quite well-known. Unfortunately, the man was not well-trained. As is commonly the case with evangelists, they have become converted, and they've been personalities. This man happened to be a rather public personality from Canada, and he'd been in the newspaper business and other things, and he was a rather engaging person, and so almost immediately upon his being converted, he was out on the evangelistic circuit, a very risky thing, because if one doesn't have the training, they can make a lot of mistakes. So he went out prematurely, as many have. Sometimes you'll find people that have been in show business, for example, who get converted and then they immediately hit the evangelistic trail as they convert others. And it's risky because they don't have enough grounding in the Word. They don't know enough. Well, this fellow came to grief. I knew him fairly well. I knew quite a bit about him. He was a contemporary of my own. Those days, and I knew quite a bit about him, and I could see signs in his deportment of weakness that I could tell then were going to get the better of him if he didn't do something about it. It comes to mind because I just read a newspaper article interviewing him. I was amazed at the thing that seemed to be the biggest thing that threw him. And I thought to myself, if he'd attended our institute over there, he probably wouldn't have been thrown by these things because we dealt quite a bit with those matters. But one of the big things that seemed to throw him was that the world was such an evil place, that there was so much misery in the world and so much distress and all of this, you know, the evils that have come upon man. But what he failed to realize is that the tornadoes that come and the evils that assault the earth are not something God has done. God does not send tornadoes or earthquakes, things like that. They are the convulsions of an earth that has been affected by the forces of evil in the world. And Satan is a great force of evil. Now, God allows this to happen to the earth for one main reason, for the testing out of those who are true to the faith, those who are in the faith. if a person remains true to God in spite of adversities, that is a true test of faith. Anybody can remain true to God if their life is always sweetness and light, if everything is always lovely. If the world's a lovely place to live in, if God makes a paradise out of it, it's not too difficult to retain faith. And when those who do come to faith are able to retain that faith in the midst of continual adversities, then it is a true test of that faith. And I've also said that the inhumanity of man to man is something that is part of the hazard of giving mankind a free will. If you give a person a free will to choose what he's going to do, then you can't interfere with that choice. I used the illustration somewhere, I don't know, perhaps in some of your hearing, of the automobile. It was up to the driver to handle the car the way he wanted to. Now, Detroit does not also build tracks on the freeways to put the car on so that there's no possibility of getting in an accident. If every car were hooked up to a cable somewhere, then there would be no accidents, but also there would be no free will or free choice in where you want to drive or how fast or whatever. You see, God gave to man a free will. Now, if he gives him a free will, he cannot also tie strings on his arms and everything. So, as I've said to you before, he doesn't tie a string around your wrist and then jerk it back just before it gets to the next fellow's nose, you know. If he's going to make a free will being, he's got to be completely free. And that's the risk of making a free moral agent. All those risks God took into consideration. Now, there are not a lot of good answers to all the problems of the world. I don't have the answers, nor do I pretend to be able to defend God. He's got to defend himself. If I can defend him successfully, then maybe I'm bigger than he is. So I don't propose to defend God, but I am saying it's unfortunate that this fellow had to give up the faith over such an issue that could rather easily be handled. Now, there's the issue of testing, though, you see. Here's a fellow who, under adversity, turned his back on God. He failed the test. God didn't fail. He failed. The psalmist says, if you faint in the day of adversity, your strength indeed is small. I went into all this because the word tempting or temptation in the Greek text means testing, and it more deeply means an assault. Satan makes an assault upon the world to try and destroy that which God has created. He makes an assault upon the soul to try and turn it away from God. Perhaps generally speaking, we are vulnerable to these assaults in terms of our natural desires. So he goes on to say here, let no one being assaulted or tested say, I am tested from God, for God does not test anyone with evil, nor is he himself tempted. But each one is tempted by his own desires when he is drawn away and enticed. Then a desire, when it has conceived, bears sin, and sin, when it has come to the full, brings forth death. Now, the kind of assault that obviously James is more particularly focusing on here does have to do with the matter of morality, the matter of our ethics or of our behavior. In other places, the same word is used for assault upon our physical person with sickness or something like that, or adversity. James says that God is not the one who does the testing. Now, that would be true of all of these forms of assault from Satan. God does not throw something at you like that. God does not bring an earthquake through the village to find out how many people are going to stand. But he allows these things to happen. And in the midst of it all, the soul will emerge victoriously. That is to say, one will retain faith in spite of the adversity. That's a true test then. But it is not that God sends it, but that it comes as a result of Satan's activity. The word desire here, which is a better word, covers all the gamut of human interests. Thus, for example, the desire for money is as much in focus here as the desire for other things. Any kind of a desire that is a self-interest can produce sin. A person who has a focus on money can let that become a stumbling block to himself or to someone else. Any area of self-interest, a person perhaps has an interest in fame. A young person may wish to go into the field of music, for example, and want to become a great pianist or whatever. All of these things are human desires. Of themselves, not too bad. But when they are allowed to come to the full, they can be a problem. They can produce wrong attitudes, wrong ideas. So it not only covers the realm of desire in the matter of human sex, and so it goes way beyond that to all kinds of earthly desires. Now he says we are vulnerable when these desires get out of hand. The thing that makes us vulnerable to Satan is that he knows where our weaknesses are. And he draws us off. So that's why he says if you have a tendency towards something, Satan can use that to draw you away. Any kind of selfish interest can draw you off and cause you to fall into sin. That old self, you see, is the great problem. In a way, to best accommodate life, you pretty well need to give up your rights. Now, that sounds like a hard statement, but it's true. If you traffic in human rights, you can be drawn into a lot of difficulties. Well, I have a right to this, and I have a right to that. I have my rights, and those are the things that sort of tear homes apart. You don't have any right to take over the bathroom. I have my rights and all this sort of thing. We're so concerned about our rights that it becomes the basis of a lot of family dissension. And we feel we have our right to nice things, for example. Or we have a right to a career. Or we have a right to this or right to that. And yet, human nature being what it is, that's always going to put us in conflict. It is, in a sense, something of letting the Lord handle that problem for us pretty well. If in order to achieve your rights, you have to step on people or create problems, then maybe you might set your rights aside. Jesus did. He said, I came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give my life a ransom for many. It's that protection of the self that is the root of so much evil in the world, our own self-interest. Well, as I've said to some recently, why don't you let your focus be on how can I help people rather than how can they help me? How can I make this situation better, not how can I get from it all that I ought to have? Everyone has in their own power the ability to make any situation better or worse by how much they demand for themselves out of it. If you keep demanding things for yourself, you can cause problems. You say, well, other people ought not to be selfish. That's true, but you can't control what they're going to do. And you think people might walk all over you. I suppose they walked on Jesus a little bit, too. It's giving up your right to yourself that is the beginning of being able to cope with this life. Or if Satan swipes something from you, instead of thrashing around like a fish in a dry bird bath or something, you just, instead of thrashing around, just commit it to Christ. Say, all right, Lord, if you feel I can get along without that, all right, I'll just leave it that way. Now, I've given you Jesus as a great example in this, although we can't always use everything as an example. He was different from us in some respects, but in John 14, it says, Jesus says, the prince of this world comes and has nothing in me. Jesus had no handles that Satan could get hold of and rattle him with. All your personal ambitions are like handles that Satan can rattle you with. That secret desire you have, that being possessed with personal rights, you see, or prepossessed with it, that obsession to get ahead in some people. But whatever we cling to for self-comfort is a handle, and Satan can get hold of that handle and rattle us with it. I've used as a classic example an individual that had lived a rather careless life, and then he came to the Lord, or renewed his commitment to Christ, and he had his eye on a very fine position in a certain community. And he was scared to death because he had done some things in his earlier days that were beginning to emerge just at the time he was being considered for this position. And he was afraid these things were going to come out. And it was a disturbing because he had just given his life to the Lord. Now he was thinking that for all of that, he was going to be aced out of his position, you see. I pointed out to him that Satan saw that ambition of his as a handle he could rattle him with. He wanted him to say, well, I was really going to come to Christ, but now it looks like everything's in jeopardy. And I said, Satan sees that ambition of yours, and what you've got to do is just put it in the Lord's hand and say, all right, Lord, if you don't want me to have this job, fine, I'll just accept that. He did this, and he got the position anyway, but the point he had to do was give it up. Well, all right, if that's not something I ought to have, fine. I talked with a man that I may have used this illustration before, but it's a very apt one, who was hyperventilating to the point that he was about to die from it. He'd been to the doctors, and they couldn't seem to help him. Hyperventilating is an excessive intake of oxygen into the bloodstream. And they do it temporarily. I mean, a surfer does it before they go into the surf, but that's a controlled thing, and they do it just to get enough oxygen so they can handle the amount of time they have to be under the water. But anyway, this fellow was uncontrollably hyperventilating. He was it was to the point that it would be fatal, and the doctors hadn't been able to do anything for him. I was working with a certain doctor, and he turned him over to me to see if I could help him. And because a lot of times it's a psychosomatic thing. For some reason, I just sensed that we ought to talk about his job. And it turned out that he had been working for a certain company for, 15 or 20 years. And he'd been passed up for a promotion. It was given to a younger man who had come to work a lot more recently than he. And he was very upset about that. Now, he didn't realize it, but that was really the thing that was causing this hyperventilation problem. The nerves were shot as a result of it, or were acting up on him. And so he was a Christian man, and I talked to him about this matter. I said, there may be any number of reasons why the Lord allowed you to be passed up for that job. And maybe it was not something that you could handle after all. Maybe there may be many reasons. So I said, what you have to do is just put it in the Lord's hands and say, all right, Lord, if that's the way you want this matter to go, I'll just leave it in your hands. And he did that, fortunately. And the problem was over. That was the end of his hyperventilation. It was the last time he went back to see the doctor on it. It just took care of it. But you see, this thing of self-ambition, things we want for ourselves, are the root of our troubles. And James brings that out. He said, Satan makes an assault upon us because we have private desires and ambitions and interests, self-interests, that come ahead of our commitment to Christ. They come ahead of our desire to help others. We're more concerned about our own thing than we are about other people's welfare. Over and over in the New Testament, the Lord talks about that. Don't be so worried about your welfare. Think more about the welfare of others. Now, that is not of itself an easy thing to handle, and it takes the power of the Spirit in us to help us get rid of this self-interest. But He is saying that that's where all temptation roots, all testing of that, because if we didn't have those self-desires and self-interest, Satan wouldn't be able to get hold of us. If a person has no ambition to be a great success in the world, Satan is not likely to tempt them with some job that is going to take them away from Christ because they're not that concerned about success. I'm not saying you shouldn't work hard and that you shouldn't get ahead. I'm just saying wherever these things are an obsession, wherever they take precedence in our lives, we have a very good breeding ground for this kind of thing. Well, I think maybe we'll stop there.